Welcome back to America's leading higher education podcast, The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. Hosts Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Leiba, and producer Elvin Freites bring you the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. We explore innovations, ideas, and issues in higher education and beyond, and hopefully have a little fun along the way. Now let's get to it. This episode of the EdUp Experience is sponsored by MDT Marketing. MDT Marketing is a digital marketing agency with a vision of creating education, marketing, and technology programs that improve people's lives. Specializing in student nurturing programs, digital advertising, marketing technology, and digital printing, MDT Marketing's seasoned team is entrusted by higher education institutional leaders to develop personalized communication strategies that are compliant and highlight what differentiates their institutions. Learn more about MDT Marketing at mdtmarketing.com. Welcome back, everybody. This is the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, interviewing the brightest and most influential minds in higher education and beyond. This is Dr. Joe Salustio, always with me, my conscience, Elizabeth Leiba. How are you doing today, Liz?
I'm doing awesome. Have you seen that meme that's going around on social media? It's like there's like a famous person on somebody's shoulder. It's kind of like Elf on the Shelf, but yeah. It's almost like you take whatever your name is and you have that person. So I might say, I don't even know, Wiz on Liz, and it'd be like Wiz Khalifa sitting on my shoulder. So I'm like that. I'm like sitting on your shoulder. Like we're going to make a little meme of me. Like I'm going to be like a little cutout.
Well, you know,
sitting on your shoulder.
I like to prop you up, Elizabeth. I'm trying to, you know, let's do what we can. I'll be your base, and you. That means you could see higher than I can, and you have to tell me what it's
that.
Like.
Yeah, I love that. Let's see the world. Let's conquer the world like that. I'm just gonna just do it.
Well, if there's one thing I could do for you, it's to take some trolls away because you have plenty. However,
I have a ton of trolls.
You have tons of online social media trolls. I can't get one to save my life.
I'm gonna throw you a couple of mine.
Oh, you have more than a couple to throw around. Let me tell you. Yeah. So whatever you can
plenty.
I'm just waiting for my first one so I can respond, and nobody will troll me. So if there's anybody out there that like to troll me, please, I'm inviting you. So let's talk about our guest today, by the way, which the entire point of this episode. On the line right now, we have Dr. Stephen Kostlin. He is president and chief academic officer of Foundry College. Stephen, how are you doing today?
Oh, very well. Thank you.
Stephen has no trolls. He is good to go.
Yeah.
The only thing trolling me, by the way, is you hear my garage door open every time somebody goes out my house.
I heard that. Yeah, that's okay.
That's the ultimate troll. Well, Stephen, we're so excited to have you. Foundry College is just, you know, when we talk about unique models being out there and it's like this mythical creature, you know, these unique higher education models, and everybody goes, yeah, okay, whatever, Joe. Foundry College is really a unique model for higher ed in the way that you've designed your curriculum. I know you're the mastermind behind much of this. Talk to us about Foundry College. What is the model? You know, what's the foundation of how you're teaching, and what's the entire point and mission of the university?
Yeah. So what we're doing now is we're trying to teach working adults, for the most part, skills and knowledge that will not be easily automated. That's the idea. Give you a toolkit that will serve you the rest of your life. So we're focusing now on 6 course sequences. The first 4 courses are foundation, things like critical thinking, clear communication, working well with others, that sort of thing, that lead to 2 courses that will get you a job credential, like an entry-level Salesforce administrator or project manager. The idea is, we're not just vocational. So we don't teach you, for example, to fix cell phones. Because if we did, well, what happens in a few years to cell phones?
It's going to be like a heads up display on your watch. Your cell phone email is going to be on your skin. You're going to be typing stuff.
It's something like that. They change. So the idea is that we don't want to be vocational because that's brittle. It doesn't prepare you to adapt as the future changes. So what we do is we give you a foundation of very general skills that are future oriented and have those lead into these job credential courses so that when you get a job, you won't be displaced as the world changes. You will have the abilities and knowledge to be able to adapt. So you won't be like people who learn to fix a cell phone and then 3 years later out of a job because cell phones change. You didn't know what to do about it.
So you're focusing on a lot of the human skills or essential skills. I hate to call them soft skills because they're not. I mean, is a lot of this the future of a human learning?
So we've been struggling with that term. We don't like soft skills either because they're really not. They're very hard to learn. So we've been thinking of them as durable skills or professional skills because they're skills that will serve you the rest of your life. They're about how to interact with people, how to solve problems, how to think critically, how to communicate, things that aren't going to change. So we use that as the foundation for these specific job credentials, with the idea being that you could always come back and get another job credential if you want.
What do you think about that, Liz?
I find this fascinating because as an instructional designer, obviously being in the classroom as a faculty member, but also as an instructional designer, my thought process always is revolving around, especially because I teach English composition, which anyone that teaches probably a gen ed knows that typically students come in and they're just like, ugh. You know, it's just like, it's a class they have to take. They're like, why do I need this? And I'm always trying to frame my delivery as far as what is in it for the student. What are you going to get out of this? How are you going to apply this? Why is this something that you should care about or that you should take? So I'm constantly looking for examples and looking for ways, like even having them do social media posts or things that will apply. So it's not just a composition class where you're writing an essay, because obviously none of us are going to write a 5-paragraph essay when we go on our job. Mm-hmm. So talk to us a little bit about your philosophy in terms of your curriculum, because I love this with the in-class exercises, the on-the-job practice, the applied learning, the real-world scenarios, how you incorporate that and what your philosophy is about that. And also, if you don't mind addressing, why is that we find in traditionally in higher ed, we find so much resistance. We find that so many schools are married to, and I'm not going to say everybody, but I went to a traditional school and they were very married to the idea of sage on the stage and the theory, and you have to learn all of the philosophy, which none of us are going to use when we go on the job. So how do we separate that and get higher ed to embrace a lot of the things that you appear to be really doubling down on in your curriculum?
Okay. Wow. Well, first of all, I must compliment you on your very much forward-looking perspective. Not many people look at things the way you have. If they did,
we try to keep those compliments to Liz at a minimum here. She's getting a big head.
I know. I'm going to not be able to talk to you after because I'm going to be like flying up into the universe here.
I'll try to get a grip on it then. Keep that under control. Okay. So where'd the curriculum come from? If you look at surveys of what employers say they're looking for, or you look at things like job ads. There was a study that looked at over 140,000 job ads. They did a big word cloud trying to identify what the ads had in common. These things all converge. What employers want are people who can solve problems, think critically, work with other people, communicate well, and so forth. These so-called soft skills. I don't like the term, but that's apparently the term that's out there. And the reason they like those is because they realize it's a great foundation for any job specific things they need to teach. The problem is only, according to surveys, only about 11% of the job candidates, this is after a bachelor's degree, actually have the kind of skills and background that the employers want. Wow. So at Foundry, we took a step back and said, well, why don't we just teach them directly? We'll teach that stuff. We'll make it the foreground, not some incidental byproduct of teaching, you know, philosophy or literature. Not to say I'm against those things, but I think if you want to teach critical thinking, why not just teach it rather than think it's going to be a byproduct of having them do other kinds of things. So we designed the foundational curriculum with that in mind, with actually teaching the kinds of skills and teaching in a way that'll be general, which is the hard part, by the way, so that students can actually use them in their real lives. They're not just things they learn in the class. Why are there places resistant to this? I think there's an enormous amount of tradition. And I think liberal arts approach has this idea that we're training good citizens and we want them to be well-rounded. And I think that's great. But I don't think a liberal arts approach is necessarily what everybody wants. It's not necessarily for everybody. I mean, learning Shakespeare and calculus is great if you're interested in Shakespeare and calculus and knowledge for knowledge's sake. It does make you a well-rounded person. But I think a lot of people really want the kinds of skills and knowledge they can use. And that's what Foundry College is about, skills and knowledge they can use. And a lot of traditional faculty, because they're focused on this goal of a liberal education, kind of look down a little bit on something that just seems applied. And again, I make this distinction between just vocational, teaching you to do a very specific job, and the kind of broad foundation gives you these general, deep, applicable skills that you can use as foundations for lots of different kinds of jobs. I think there's a distinction there. So what we're doing is different. But even what we're doing, I think, is really not what most traditional faculty have in mind or find compatible with the goals they have.
So let's drill down a little bit and talk about delivery method and practically how you're navigating doing all this on your campus. What is your Forge classroom about? Because I was fascinated by that structure and that platform. How do you use that to create the environment where you're giving a student all of that practical hands-on knowledge?
Yeah, great. So I just published a book about 2 months ago, which I'm going to shamelessly plug right now.
Of course.
Called Active Learning Online. Five principles that make online courses come alive.
Oh my gosh, that sounds awesome. I'm like literally writing that down right now because I'm going to order it as soon as we get off of
here. I can hear you scribbling.
I got my notepad.
Your friendly Kindle store. So it's it's a very short book. It's like 102 pages long. And I really tried to boil down the science of learning, which is immense. Tried to boil it down to five principles. There are things like, well, let me give an example. So have you ever, either of you, at the end of the day, ever as you're like going to sleep or something, reflected back on what you did during the day?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yep. All right. So here's the real question I'm interested in. What percentage of what you remember at the end of the day do you think when it actually happened earlier during the day, you intentionally tried to memorize it, to remember it? Was
none.
It 50%?
Zero.
Okay, well, so I've asked this question to thousands of people now, and I do it. I start by asking it 50%. No one's ever said that. And then I go to 25%. I've had three, which I'm still not sure that they understood what I was asking exactly. But then I go down in 5% increments, and the average number is about 5% is what people say. That about 5%, think about this for a second, about 5% of what you remember at the end of the day, you tried to memorize when it was happening. So 95%, if we take these reports at face value, and they're quite consistent, by the way, say 95% of what you remember, you didn't try to remember, which is totally consistent with the empirical literature, the laboratory results on memory. A huge amount of what we remember is what's called incidental memory. It's not intentional. It's a byproduct of paying attention and thinking about something. Think about this. A lot of your memory springs up because you paid attention and thought about something. Okay? Now, we can engage those same brain mechanisms in teaching. And that's what we do on the Forge. So the Forge is about active learning. We have students do problem solving, debates, role playing, many, many things. I've got dozens of these examples in that little book that I wrote. And Forge is set up so we can do things like a jigsaw classroom really easily. You know what a jigsaw classroom is?
No.
It was invented by Elliot Aronson in the early 70s and really didn't go anywhere because it was logistically really hard to do. So let me give you a simple example just so you'll get the idea. It's sequences of breakout groups. So say we have the first phase, we have groups who are preparing to debate. Say they're going to debate, is city life better than country living? Okay. So you have some groups that are preparing to debate city life is better. You know, there's cafes and restaurants, music and all that. Other groups are going to argue that country life is better. It's slower, it's more relaxed. You get the nature of the countryside and so forth. Okay. So they prepare pro or con, say. All right. That's phase one. Phase two is you now break those groups up and reassemble them. This is the jigsaw piece. So now you have new groups where, say, there were two people from a pro group in favor of city, say, and two people from a con group. And you have them debate and try to identify the strongest and weakest arguments, which they later have to write down and maybe they get graded. So the idea is, in that first phase, they know what's coming. They know they're going to have to defend their position. So they pay attention. They think about it. Paying attention and thinking it through are major ways we learn things, just by being engaged. So by setting up the contingencies of a jigsaw classroom, where the first phase is preparing for a second phase where they know they're going to have to come through, and then the second phase prepare for yet another phase. So by setting up these kind of sequential contingencies, you can motivate people to pay attention, think it through, and thereby learn it. So the Forge was built with this kind of thing in mind. It's really easy to do this, much easier it is to do it on Zoom, for example. You can do it on Zoom, but it's clunky. I talk about how to do it in that book I wrote, but it's not as elegant and simple as it could be.
And I love that. I love the idea of being intentional, because I think today's student, especially, I'm a Gen Xer, so I feel as though just, and this is not to, I guess, say all Gen Xers think this way, but for me, I always just did things because I was told to do them. Like, that was how I was raised. It's like, you just do what you're told to do. And I think this, my daughter's 21, she's a Gen Z, and they, I feel, just from interacting with them in the classroom as a faculty member and also from raising my daughter, is that they don't want to just do things because you said so. Like, they are very practical in, well, why am I doing this? They question everything. So I love this idea of setting the expectation and building on that, so that there is that what's in it for me. It's something that builds, and they can see what the journey culminates in, and it builds on each other, rather than just saying, you just have to learn this because.
I think that's dead right. So I think the key is to have well-defined learning objectives, that you know what it is you want them to learn. You know what the learning outcomes ought to be at the end. And it's transparently obvious why it's in their interest to learn it. Mm-hmm. So if you set up the act of learning, so you have like a role-playing scenario or something where it's just obvious this is going to apply in the real world, mm-hmm. you know, like you're training them to negotiate mm-hmm. and in a way that it's real world kind of negotiation, so that they can see it. That taps intrinsic motivation. Mm-hmm. So if you combine intrinsic motivation where they can see why it's in their interest with this kind of incentive-based stuff I was just talking about, where they have to prepare because they know something else is coming, you get powerful motivation where they, in fact, will engage, and they will do the kinds of things that active learning taps. Well, they'll really learn it. Learning objective.
I love it.
It's interesting because my big takeaway in all that is that there's a huge part of the population that remembers 5% more intentionally than I do, Liz, and you do. So, you know, we'll have to.
We were at zero.
You're at zero so fast, too. We didn't even need to think about it. It's a problem. You know, Stephen, this is the interesting part about you is that, looking through your bio, you're very classically trained, if you will, in higher education with the institutions that you've either taught for, the degrees that you've earned, the institutions that you've earned them from. You're looking at this at Foundry College through a non-traditional educational lens. So you've effectively made a transition that those outside the industry of higher ed have really been beating the drum for, right? There's the traditionalism of higher education. You know, traditionally, we're not open to new ideas. We're looking at things in the box that exist. How did you make the journey going from, you know, classically higher ed trained, going through, you know, really traditional institutions to coming up with something like Foundry College, where it's really business responsive? future-proof education?
Yeah, so I was in the Harvard faculty for about 3 decades. I was the department chair of Department of Psychology and was a dean there. I was dean of social sciences. And one of the things I did, I was involved in redoing general education for Harvard. It's one of 6 faculty that was asked to be on that committee. And that was kind of eye-opening because I really started thinking about what general education actually is and what it should be. So clearly what it is based in large part on tradition. All curricula in North America have 3 components. They have general education, a major, and electives. And those are pretty well defined. But I started thinking about it. And one thing led to another. And I ended up at Minerva, which was the first startup university in I don't know how many years. Ben Nelson managed to get $25 million based on a PowerPoint presentation. So I was the first academic they hired. It was the chief academic officer there and put that together. And it was a chance at the academic program together. It was a chance to really take a step back and ask, you know, moving in 21st century here, what should an education look like? I mean, what kinds of skills, not just knowledge, but skills and knowledge should people have in order to adapt to a world that's rapidly changing? So the transition for me from traditional academia to the kind of thing I'm doing now via Minerva was kind of seamless. It was really built again on this idea of learning objectives. I mean, what is it that we really would want students to learn for their own good? For their own good, so that we can help further their goals, help them further their goals, give them the tools so they can accomplish what they want to, because we can't tell them what they should want to do. So all of that came incrementally, and along with it came a lot of new methods, pedagogy that drew on all the science of learning stuff that I've learned over the years. So that the science of learning stuff is really quite general. You can use it to teach just about anything. But it's turned out with things like the Forge, we brought them together, the particular content and the methods, kind of the technologies built to promote both at the same time. And it's actually worked amazingly well. I mean, the last 4 trimesters at Foundry, the net promoter score has been over 60. And the most recent one was 69.3, which is incredibly hard.
It's great.
High for an NPS score. So it seems to be working quite well.
What is your marketing challenge? Are you pacing short for your start? Is your cost per inquiry increasing? From sophisticated software, multi-touch omni-channel nurturing to the latest in digital media, MDT will help your school captivate, resonate, and automate your marketing efforts. Learn more about MDT marketing at mdtmarketing.com. Your marketing challenges end here.
So was, you know, now let's bring things back to today and in terms of the pandemic, you know, future ready, were you guys pandemic ready? And in the certificate trainings that you're putting out there, have they been proving to be in demand, especially during the economic downturn as it exists now? You know, a lot of folks out of work, have you been able to weather that storm, thrive through the storm? Give us your once over on how the pandemic has affected your trajectory.
It's been a mixed bag. I mean, I'm not recommending this pandemic's really horrible. It's really terrible. There's just no getting around that. So the bad part has been we've been focusing on working adults, and a lot of the kind of people we'd like to have as students are unemployed, and they're not in a position to be able to enroll right now, which is unfortunate, because at least I view it that way, because I think what we teach is really an investment in someone's future, something they can use. On the other hand, we have just shown that, in fact, it works. People can get jobs, Salesforce administrator, for example, based on what we've taught them. So we're selecting additional credentials courses to develop now. We won't have 2 that are currently being taught, but we'll double that shortly. with an eye towards jobs that will not be easily automated, are in demand across the geography of the United States, at least, can be done remotely, so that, in fact, that even gives a greater reach, and that lend themselves to the kind of active learning that we do, that don't just entail massive amounts of memorization. We could do that too, but it's a lot more fun if we can get jobs that we can teach using a whole range of active learning techniques. So we are developing Work Credentials courses. But I think the pandemic in general has shown that remote learning, if done well, can be very effective. This is one of the forces of using the Forge in active learning and all that. So that was a demonstration. I think people paid attention to it maybe in a way they wouldn't have otherwise. But on the other hand, it's really been very bad for way too many people. It's just, it'll be really good when we're past this. I don't think anybody would disagree with that statement.
No, I don't think so. And has the pandemic done a positive consequences or done, that's not the right way to say it, but have there been any positive consequences in terms of future planning where you guys have sat down and said, okay, this has really eradicated certain jobs, you know, it's shown the need for others. Can we be responsive to the marketplace or the future marketplace and come up with some new programs, new curriculum that could be the future program that nobody's thinking about yet?
So a couple of things on that. One is, I think it's emphasized the usefulness of teaching people to do jobs, that can be done. But more than that, I think it's shown that the technology is really useful if used well, so that moving forward, I think we're going to be thinking a lot more about hybrid than we used to. I think this is something that probably people wouldn't have thought about as much as they will now. And in particular, there's going to be a parsing. We're going to think about what can be done asynchronously. You know, like in a flipped classroom where the first part is you read and watch videos or whatever, say, just, content delivery. But the live part, the synchronous part, I think we're going to divide into two components. I mean, what do you need to do in person and what can you do over Zoom or something like that? So that's going to be an interesting exercise in figuring out exactly what the hybrid classroom of the future is going to look like. I suspect that a fair amount of what we thought required in person can actually be done effectively in synchronous, real-time, Zoom-like environments, Forge-like environments, if you use the proper techniques, like the kind of pedagogy that underlies active learning, which I described in that little book of mine. So I think that's going to be a sea change when we emerge from this that probably wouldn't have happened if the pandemic hadn't come along.
That's so interesting to me, because you alluded to, and you have a couple of times, about different ways that we can reimagine or restructure the way that we deliver. So if it's a hybrid learning model or something like the Forge environment that you have, or if we're thinking about just the ROI and the practical and the active learning. In your, I guess, imagination, because I think about this sometimes, what would that ideal, like, are there certain things that you think, because I know for myself and Joe, sometimes we talk about the idea that stackable credentials should be just something that's a part of the gen ed experience where students are going through their program and they're able to, just as a matter of course, not something that is like, oh, that's so revolutionary. It should be something where students are able to get certifications along the way, and then those build toward a degree program, things of that nature. I always wonder about the need for gen ed. Are there things that you think, wow, it would be so great if I had a magic wand, if I could make education this way, where kind of along the lines of your philosophy, there are things that maybe as we all come out of this, education, higher education, can think about how we can reimagine and really, I don't even know, just totally restructure the way that we deliver education to our students.
So you've hit on a bunch of different things there. Let me just free associate slightly to some of them. One about stackable credentials. I'm totally with you. I think, do you know about the evolution of the eye?
No.
Okay, this is a great analogy. So how do you think about an eye? You know, it's like it's this beautifully integrated system. How could it have evolved a little piece at a time? Well, a bunch of people who are much smarter than I have sort of figured this out. So here's a standard story. You've got this proto fish laying on the bottom of a ocean millions and millions of years ago, and it lays there, and if it moves, some predator may see it and eat it. Now, let's say by a mutation, it develops a light-sensitive patch of skin. Well, now if a shadow goes over it, it may freeze. Okay, that's going to be adaptive because it won't move when the predators nearby won't get eaten as often. So it's going to have more kids that survive than the ones that didn't get that patch. So that patch goes through the population. Now say there's another mutation, which is a little dimple right at that spot. So you now have more surface area for the same amount of light coming down. So it's more sensitive. So that's going to be more useful. And now, but there's a problem. Silt will come in and sometimes fill the little dimple. So say you get a clear covering over it. Okay, another mutation. Well, that's going to be even better. And then a little thickening in it. That's a lens. So at the point being, at every step, you have something that's useful in its own right. Okay, but another step on top of it makes it even more useful. But you didn't need the final goal to be there all at once. You do it a little bit at a time. Sure. I think you can think about stackable education the same way. That is, you can teach people things that from the beginning are useful and obviously so. And I don't, when I say useful, I'm not just talking about, you know, getting a job. I mean, useful for you as a human being, mm-hmm. how to interact with other people, how to manage yourself, you know, how to, it's sort of some ethics that are practical, how to be proactive, how to navigate the kind of systems that we find ourselves in, you know, economic systems, medical systems. How do you function as a person in this society? I mean, things that are obviously useful. I think we can stack those up and along the way, give them credentials so they get some credit, quote unquote, mm-hmm. for having achieved what they've achieved, which employers will recognize as being useful. Mm-hmm. So I think stackable credentials are without question a way to go, in my opinion. Okay, about Gen Ed, you mentioned that. I think the basic idea underlying Gen Ed was a good idea. I just don't think it's been done well. And usually it's you know, a set of requirements, right? There's like a, you have to take two from this column and this column, mm-hmm. two from this one and two from that one, you know, natural science, social science, arts, humanities, whatever. There's no coherence. There's right. no structure. They're just introductory, stick your toe in the water, it's lukewarm, you know, what for? yeah. But if you did Gen Ed right, where you really treat it as a foundation, and I don't mean just a foundation for the rest of college, but a foundation for life, I think that's pretty cool. I that's what we've right. done at Foundry. We developed a new kind of Gen Ed course. We did that at Minerva too, different one. Minerva is a liberal arts approach. It has a different kind of Gen Ed than Foundry does, which is a more applied kind of approach. But nevertheless, the concept of Gen Ed, I think, is fine. And I think the concept of a major is fine, in the sense that you focus on one thing and get some depth in it, and it's up to you to choose it. The electives, usually in college, that's what the faculty are interested in, not so much what the students are. That, mm-hmm. I think, could use a little work. But I think the general structure of what we got is pretty, it's pretty serviceable. It's just what you do with it. And then the last thing you said was about the delivery. Well, that's where I think there's going to be some changes based on what we've learned through this forced march through Zoom and so on during the pandemic. there's some things in technology than we can in person. I think what I was mentioning earlier about the sequences of breakout groups in a jigsaw classroom, you can't really do that so easily in person. You know, you have groups in the corner, you have them drag their chairs to the corner of the room and then try to reassemble them. It just doesn't work very well, but it's really easy to do with technology. So I think we need to parse what's good to do asynchronously, what they do on their own time, that is. And then things are done live. What should we do with it's technology mediated and what should be done in person? So I think that's going to evolve. And I think the end result is going to end up being stronger than what we started with.
And I love that you address that, because not only, I think sometimes a lot of the students and myself and Joe have talked about pedagogy and how everyone's doing Zoom University, and sometimes people are getting Zoom fatigue. But what you're talking about is there is efficacy in doing live. That part, we're not saying that you can't do live, but it has to be intentional in how you use live. And I think what people are doing is saying, okay, I would lecture for an hour, so I'm going to lecture at these boxes on my screen for an hour and expect that that's going to have good results. And students are like, no. But if you got them in there and they were in breakout groups and that was live, that would work. So there's, I think you really like hit the nail on the head in terms of us being a lot more intentional in what we do asynchronously, what we do synchronously, the pedagogy, and making it so that it fits the needs of the student. Because I think sometimes it's just fitting the needs of us trying to say, okay, we have a live class, so you're going to get exactly what you get on campus, which is absolutely not true. And the students are rebelling, and the students are like, no, this is not what I want. And it's, we're not mobilizing this technology in a way that is going to engage the student, but the technology itself can be used to engage.
I totally agree. 100% agree with everything you just said. Spot on.
Thank you.
It's a first for everything, isn't there, Liz?
There you go. That made my day.
I mean, talking about a great point for me to jump in, let me tell you.
Jump on in there.
Well, Stephen, I actually have a question about partnerships, because your model's unique. Creating a pipeline that you're accessing a pipeline of students that exists that is being clarified, particularly when you talk to the marrying of education and business. There's got to be a lot of degree institutions out there interested in taking on those students once they're trained and looking at providing credit or otherwise. Are you fielding a lot of requests for partnerships right now?
We've reached out to two for articulation agreements, you know, where they will take our students for further education along a traditional path. And those are still being negotiated. I think a lot of what's happened is kind of in higher education is kind of a whiplash phenomenon. I mean, I think it's just this pandemic has just been a trauma on so many different levels. And it's caused some innovation because of necessity, but it's also caused a lot of narrow focusing on what needs to be done right now and less interest in expanding what they've already done in most cases. At least that's been the experience I've had so far.
The whiplash phenomenon. That's really interesting. And you're so right. And you think about some of the conversations we've had where it's this jarring of movement, you know, that you've had the whiplash take place. You're trying to figure out your surroundings, adapt right now to what's happening around you with less focus on what the future looks like because you've got to handle what's in your immediate purview. And that's a really interesting way to say it, because I think that's so true. And, you know, one of the things that we've talked about on this podcast is the need for pretty sophisticated marketing in what I think, and there are those that disagree, what I think is the most competitive time for higher education that's ever existed, because every school has gone online, at least in some capacity. How are you guys looking at marketing and planning for marketing and getting your message out there and what that strategy looks like in general?
Yeah, Karen Adams is our chief of marketing, and she's superb. She's really good. Our approach has been to try to make partnerships, in particular with organizations. So there's in Tulsa, Oklahoma, there's something called Atento and the George Kaiser Family Foundation, which have been interested in inducing people to move to Tulsa. And part of the inducement is they'll help them to actually get through our curriculum. They'll help support them to do that. So that kind of partnership has worked out quite well. But there are also other partnerships we're negotiating with traditional universities where they essentially take our program as kind of a self-contained module that they can plug in and white label so that they can offer it to their current students. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there. And I think people like Karen sort of know how to navigate those waters. And we'll see how it goes.
All right, Liz, you want to give them the final two?
Absolutely. We're so honor that you were able to join us. This has been really informative. This has given me a lot to think about, and it's definitely given us a lot of insight into some of the great things that you're doing at your institution. Also some things that, you know, let's hope that people are able to maybe model, and those of us that work in the sector can start to think outside the box. And it's definitely, as we navigate post-COVID times, I'm sure this is going to be some valuable. And I hope people reach out and get your book and start to just expand, you know, how they think about how we deliver this this product and education to our students in a more effective manner. So we thank you so much for joining us. And we just want to ask two last questions, which would be, if there's anything that we've missed, anything that you want to talk about as far as Foundry College and things that you're doing there, and then what do you see, which you've alluded to a little bit, but maybe just your Cliff Notes version of what you see as the future of higher education.
So first of all, I really enjoyed this. You've asked great questions. You've gotten me thinking, and it's always fun to do that. So I really appreciate your paying attention and thinking it through and coming
now, Stephen, are you talking to Liz in particular, or would that include both?
Of course, he was talking to me.
Okay.
I'm going to include both of
just,
you.
I just like for our entire audience
think,
to hear.
I think you're a team. I mean, it's pretty clear you've worked together pretty effectively in the past and got this down.
Yeah,
so I appreciate
there you go.
That. So, you know, I don't actually think there's one future for higher education. I think there's going to be multiple different futures, and what's good for one certain person may not be good for others, and vice versa. So I think we're going to see an expansion of associate degree programs, which will be the result of stackable credentials. And I think you'll see different kinds of bachelor programs than we have now that are widely different in terms of the extent to which they're focused purely on liberal arts kinds of things and more practical things that are wrapped in liberal arts frameworks, which are put to good use to help people navigate the world and get on with their lives. So I think we're going to see an enriched ecosystem. I know a lot of people are saying that a lot of colleges are going to go out of business and so on. That may be, I don't know, but I do know there's going to be more competition, as you alluded to earlier. And so there's going to be more differentiation, which I think is a good thing. I think having more differentiation is going to be good for everybody, the colleges, the faculty, and most importantly, the students. So it may turn out that is an unexpected, unintended consequence of the pandemic that in the long run ends up being actually to the good. We'll have to see.
Really interesting. Thank you so much, Stephen. This has been Dr. Stephen Coslin, President and Chief Academic Officer of Foundry College. Stephen, it's been an honor to speak with you. I feel smarter having discussed with you. We will make sure to pick up that book. Give us the title one more time.
It's called Active Learning Online, Five Principles That Make Online Courses Come Alive.
And we can pick that up right on Amazon?
Yep.
Outstanding. Yeah.
Outstanding. I appreciate your interest. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks well, this has time. Been an honor and another episode of the EdUp Experience. We'll talk to you all again soon.
Hope you enjoyed that episode. To learn more about the EdUp Experience, please visit edupexperience.com. And if you want to be in on the live recordings, please sign up for our email list. Go to edupexperience.com and sign up to be a subscriber. We'll let you know how you can listen live and get the scoop before anyone else. So please always feel free to share this podcast, rate, review, and subscribe. We would really appreciate that. You've been listening to the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business.